Hello, and you're most welcome to Legatum Institute. This is an educational charity, and I'm the executive director. My name is Sian Hansen, and we are just thrilled to be launching our 2014 Africa Prosperity Index tonight. Now, you may be a first-time visitor to Legatum Institute. Just so you know, we're, as I said, an educational charity, and we promote prosperity. That is our mission. We define prosperity in its widest sense, which is wealth and well-being. And we do this through a series of research projects. We publish about 35 reports a year, but most important are these kind of events. So we hold, I think it's up to 120 a year, and you're most welcome to get involved. Please go to our website. You'll find lots of information. There's a number of staff in the room tonight, and they'll be perfectly willing to help you. Importantly, I'd like to invite, welcome our online audience. We have a live web stream tonight, which is why we started very precisely. And now I'd like to introduce you to Solène. She's one of the authors of the Africa Index, and she's going to tell you a little bit more about the overall concept, and then we're going to move into a discussion. Again, thank you very much. Come and talk to me later if you'd like to, and you're very welcome at the Institute.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming tonight. I know we're competing with Christmas parties, nativity plays, and holiday preparations, so I'm delighted by the great turnout. Thank you very much as well to our followers, international followers on the live stream. We're all familiar with the term Africa Rising. It's rooted in optimism, reflecting the high growth rates in the past decade. But not everyone has bought this narrative. Africa is a continent. So where can we see the rise? And for whom is Africa rising? The 2014 Africa Prosperity Report seeks to answer these questions. We rank prosperity for 38 African countries. The rankings are based on a broad understanding of prosperity across eight dimensions. We measure economy and entrepreneurship and opportunity, but also governance, education, health, safety and security, social capital and personal freedom. These are all essential components of a nation's wealth and well-being. They explain why in our index, Kenya and Senegal have risen in the past years, while Malawi and Egypt have declined. If we look at the map of Africa, we can see how differently countries perform. Botswana has been ranked first for the past 3 years, and the Central African Republic is ranked last. Central African countries tend to rank at the bottom, while Western and Eastern African countries tend to rank in the middle. Across the continent, we can see that economy and entrepreneurship and opportunity have been rising in the past years. Education has also risen, but performance still tends to be low in many countries. The most worrying trend is in terms of safety and security. Most African countries are less safe and their citizens less secure than in 2012. So as African economies grow, how can we ensure that most people enjoy the benefits of this new prosperity? So the 2014 Africa Prosperity Report looks at three key actors: well-educated people, female entrepreneurs, and the middle class. Education is essential to empower people both economically and politically. We can say that education has improved, enrollment rates have increased, and so has government spending. But in too many countries, your schooling depends on living in a city, having money, or being a boy. The quality of education also remains a problem. As we can see on this map, many Africans are still dissatisfied with their education system. Our report discusses ways to improve both the quality and access to education. In essence, our case studies show that an African child will be much more motivated if they're taught about African history and indigenous knowledge rather than British history and current affairs, and can be learning online or using an iPad. As we could see, entrepreneurship has risen in the past years. Yet women are still left out. The obstacles in their way are economic, socio-political, and cultural. Women, for instance, have low access to business networks or property rights. This needs to change, as does their access to schooling. Rwanda, the focus of one of our case studies, shows that including women in the political process can improve their inclusion in business. Egypt, unfortunately, shows another story. As you can see on the slide, the already female unfriendly environment has worsened since 2010. So the gender gap in business ownership has increased. Women feel less safe working alone at night. They also rate the economic situation as poor and business as corrupt in their countries. Yet women, who tend to invest more in the long-term prosperity of their families and communities, are crucial to a nation's economic success. The rise of the middle class in Africa has been widely discussed. The middle class buys cars and loves fast food. Look at our case study in Nigeria. This is what drives consumption and growth. But the middle class is also more likely to vote and volunteer their services for a charity, driving long-term prosperity. Our report shows that the middle class tends to be better educated, has more stable jobs, and better access to media. They're also more satisfied with their job and business environment, their living standards, education, and freedom of choice, as we can see for Algeria, Morocco, and South Africa here. So with a large part of the population in Africa still living on less than $2 a day, there's still much to be done to create a true and stable middle class in most African countries. Yet by supporting education quality, female entrepreneurship, and the rising middle class, the continent would go a long way in promoting prosperity. So I would like to encourage you all to read the report, and we very much welcome your feedback on it. We're looking forward to continuing this conversation with you in the future with events and publications. And before I finish, I would like to thank all the authors who contributed to this report. The authors are from across the continent and abroad and represent a variety of sectors. You can find their profiles and biographies on page 41 in the report. Thank you very much.
The Legatum Institute is thrilled tonight to welcome as our principal speaker Richard Dowden, who is Executive Director of the Royal African Society. The term Africa Hand is often used. In Richard's case, it's Africa Head, Africa Lungs, Africa Heart. He has dedicated 30 years or more of his life to the continent, to promoting its image, to promoting its interests. It started this love affair back in the days of Idi Amin, when Richard was a young volunteer teacher in Uganda. It continued through a brief time as editor of the Catholic Herald, and then on as Africa editor at The Economist, and it has culminated in his present post and in a highly acclaimed book, Africa Altered States, Ordinary Miracles, which is available through Portobello Books, let me not forget to say. And we are thrilled to have him here today to tell us where Africa is now. Once Richard has finished his speech, we will have a response from Marianne Jam, who is of Ghanaian and Senegalese parentage, is a force of nature. She is one of the great tech activists of Africa, and has been singled out by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader today, and as one of the 20 youngest power women of Africa by Forbes magazine. So treat her with care. Gingerly.
Very scared now. I'm never going to have a husband like that.
I'm a very well-known matchmaker. But Richard, if you would lead us on with where is Africa now?
Thank you very much, Christine. I'm blushing from your introduction. I never call myself an Africa expert. it's like saying I'm an expert on the world, because Africa's world is so vast and diverse, you can't possibly be an expert on it. I've just done it for a long time, and I've been to almost every country at some stage. But understanding it and how it works and why it is the way it is, I still struggle to understand. I think if we were meeting here 10 years ago, it would have been an index on poverty. You remember in 2005, Tony Blair launched the Commission for Africa, and it was a place that we were supposed to feel sorry for and supposed to give our aid to and help. I think if anybody suggested we should be doing this now, they would just be laughed out of court. I mean, the idea of a British Prime Minister having a commission for Africa and sorting out all Africa's problems, we now realise was a gross, almost preposterous sort of suggestion. I mean, it can only be done by Africans. But in its way, it did actually put Africa on the map. But it did give it that image that Africa has stuck with. the question I always like to try and address things historically, and then just ask, well, why is the oldest continent where we all came from about 2 million years ago? I mean, all humans came from originally from Africa. Why is it the continent that's at the bottom of the pile these days in terms of wealth and development? And in recent years, it hasn't exactly been the Garden of Eden. Although it is extremely bountiful, it has parts of it have a wonderful climate. And it's also very beautiful, extraordinarily beautiful parts of Africa. And under its soil is all the minerals that humans need. Maybe that's one of the reasons it is the way it is. But it does occupy, out of all the countries of the world, of the 20 bottom places on human development, it occupies 18 of them. Its countries occupy 18 of them. And that's a cause for inspiration, I think, to try and do something about it, but also, I think, a cause for some concern. There definitely have been some improvements in the last 10 years. There's no question about that. I think the whole attitude of the outside world to Africa has changed. And it's most extreme from save Africa, you know, let's go and save Africa. I always slightly caricatured it as saving Africa from the Africans, because it all had to be done by white NGOs and the UN and people like that, rather than asking Africans what they wanted. But it also created a tone where it disempowered Africa. I'd like to then just run very quickly through the history, starting at the time when the Europeans really got seriously interested in Africa, in the mid-19th century. About 80 million to 100 million people living in Africa. But there are something between 6,000 and 10,000 political units, depending on how you count various areas, whether they were real political power centers or just owed their allegiance to some higher power. So you could just, what I'd love to do is try to imagine what the map of Africa would have looked like if nobody had come and taken it over. So can you imagine, you know, there's the United Nations with 10,000 African countries. It's a permanent majority, I think. 2,000 languages, again, some of them linked, some of them not so linked. And then suddenly, very, very suddenly, they're sliced up by people sitting in Brussels and Paris and London saying, we will have that bit. Well, no, that's your bit. No, we want this bit. No, all right, you have that bit, I'll have that bit. Every single inch of Africa, except Ethiopia, which used the opportunity to extend its own territory by making a deal with the European powers. And I always like to tease the Ethiopians about their imperialism. But the rest of the continent carved up between Europe. And for a very short space of time, when you think about it, it was about 1900 by the time they actually got their feet on the ground. And it was only, what, 50 years later when they suddenly said, oh, we're leaving now, off we go. We're not going to fight for these places, and Africa is ready to rule itself. I think the most damaging thing was the psychological impact, the loss of African self-confidence. And that has lasted quite a while, and I'll come back to that. Then suddenly this independence, and I love Chinua Achebe's characterization of it as a house that was built in Africa, and suddenly the white people living in it suddenly said, we're leaving. And he says the smartest, the fastest, but not always the best, ran towards the house and got in there first, and then slammed the doors and announced on loudspeakers that the victory, we proclaimed victory, and the house is now ours. You people out in the rain still will have to wait a little bit longer, however. But you'll get there in the end, and they've been there ever since. I think that's quite a good characterization of the history of post-independence Africa. And it happened during the Cold War, when, of course, it really mattered whose side you were on. And therefore, both sides, both the Soviet Union and the Europeans, wanted to make sure that their man was in power. So there was no democracy or anything like that, but it was quite stable in a way. But at the end of the Cold War, Europe, America, just went for Eastern Europe, and they abandoned Africa. I can remember so many businesses, diplomats, people I had good contacts with, suddenly saying, oh, I'm off to Budapest tomorrow, I'm off to Moscow, I'm off. And Africa was just left to the tender mercies of the World Bank and the IMF, who imposed structural adjustment, which I think in the way it was imposed was, I just think it was a crime against humanity. It suddenly reduced, currencies were floated, and suddenly people who were earning a salary had nothing. I remember talking to a doctor in Congo, whose salary was worth $10 a month, and he had five children. And I said, not a doctor, a judge. And I said, well, how do you operate? And he said, well, there are three ways. One is that I give an absolutely straightforward judgment and try and live on $10 a month. Not many of us do that. Another way is to go around the litigants and say, right, what will you give me? And reward the highest bidder. And the other way is just to make the judgment and then go to the person who's won and then say, I helped you, now will you help me? And that's how he survived, just by trying to be honest, but then having to beg for money at the end of it. And I think that's not untypical of that period, when the middle classes were utterly, completely destroyed, except the ones in power, who were then able to grab the privatized state companies for a knockdown price and are now largely Africa's billionaires. The prescription, of course, at the end of the Cold War was human rights, democracy, and the free market. And certainly the third one has triumphed. I'm just not too sure about the others. But it did plunge the whole of the continent into... I think the worst period. The 90s in Africa were a really, really bad period. The economy stayed very flat, and I counted 24 wars in that period. I'm open to other bids. I mean, there were a lot of either major insurrection or wars. Millions of people died in that decade. In Congo, Africa's, which people still really rarely talk about because it's an embarrassment, but it is the heart of Africa. There were, at one stage, 11 African armies, looting, pillaging, raping, killing in Congo, and trying to fight each other. And the two people who started it, the two countries that started it, Rwanda and Uganda, then even fell out between them. And they destroyed Kisangani in a artillery battle, just Museveni versus Kagame, for who was going to control Eastern Congo. And that was a dreadful time. But gradually growth resumed, and the drivers of growth were not Western aid, they were China's demand for Africa's raw materials, mobile phones, and the middle classes picking themselves up and reviving. And gradually democracy spread, or at least elections. Nowadays, I think elections are quite well managed in that there are fewer changes of government now than there have ever been, but at least all the countries have them. So it's a bit of a mixed picture throughout the continent at the moment. North of the Sahara, you've got the Arab Spring, which has really turned into an Islamic versus Muslim but non-Islamic war. So that model that looked like it might even spread to the rest of Africa has sort of fallen away. And south of the Sahara, there has been a lot of growth, particularly with oil and gas, but with oil prices now dropping, countries that have spent on the basis of getting oil, countries like Ghana, are now in deep difficulties because they've borrowed heavily against their oil, which is now getting less and less valuable every day. It's been a resources story so far, which means that the wealth has stayed at the top, and we still have something like 70 to 80% of people living in poverty. Yes, the middle classes are there, but increasingly I find they're living in gated communities and just not engaging with the rest of the population. And I was at some... It's not often you hear a... it's not often you hear a vice president of the World Bank calling for revolution. But at the Royal African Society annual lecture last week, I don't know if many people were there, Obi Ezekwesili, who was a former minister in Nigeria and is a vice president of the World Bank, actually said, you know, the only way things will change is when people stand up and demand them. And that's what that is the next stage. It's Africans have to organize and demand of their governments they want what they want. And if the governments don't react, they must overthrow them. She praised the people of Burkina Faso for overthrowing Kampare recently. So as I say, it is. I think she typified Africa as Nigeria, but I think Nigeria is the country that has that very small, tiny elite 1% owning about 90% of Nigeria, and it's unsustainable, and it has to end in some sort of settlement or revolution. So in that way, I think actually we're in for quite interesting times in Africa. I think the other point she made were very valid as well. Development can only be delivered by the people themselves. Of course, the IMF, the World Bank, other countries can try and improve governance, they can try and improve economies, but in the end, development has to be done by the people. And a second point was that it's time Africans stood up and demanded that their government either changed or got out of the way. The two biggest economies in Africa, Nigeria and South Africa, are in some ways they're the ones who should be driving the continent. But you look at Nigeria in the index, its safety and security is lower than Zimbabwe's. It's 31st in governance. It comes right at the bottom on all the things that citizenship need. And I think now they've got this battle with Boko Haram, the weakness of Nigeria is really beginning to show. And if it can't defeat a rebel movement like that, then I think the state of Nigeria is in serious trouble. But it has an election next year, so I think these could be quite interesting times. And South Africa, yes, second on entrepreneurship, but 10th in the safety and security ranking. And I think there again, it's not a safe place. The best countries seem to be the small ones, and they're not only the top in the Legatum index, but also in the Moebius index as well. Countries like Botswana, Namibia, small countries where there are real opportunities for small people to do things, and they don't have to depend on a big protector in order to do some business. So I think that's that may be something where these countries like South Africa and Nigeria are just too big to manage themselves. Congo, obviously, another biggie that cannot manage itself. Sudan, the same. That there may be a connection there. But the fastest growing, according to the IMF, and I got a briefing from someone from the IMF last night, the fastest growing and delivering development are Ethiopia and Rwanda, which are extremely effective. And I haven't been in Rwanda for a while, but in Ethiopia I've been to recently. And yes, way out in the most rural areas, there'll be a school which works, which kids turn up to, teachers turn up to, people learn things. There's water, there'll be an agricultural project. It's really quite remarkable how far out into the rural areas the government has brought development. However, in neither country is there very much respect for human rights, and in neither country is there a proper democracy. So that original thing of Hank Cohen, the American Assistant Secretary of State in the 90s, who said, yes, the prescription is human rights, democracy, and the free market. Hank had a lovely sense of humor. He said, democracy, human rights, the free market, but if you get the third one right, you might get a discount on the other two. And I think that's precisely what's happened, that nobody complains about Rwanda and Ethiopia simply because they are developing. They're delivering stuff for their own people very effectively, whereas everybody complains about some of the others. Bill Clinton famously said, it's the economy, stupid, but I always say in Africa, it is the politics. And that is the political divisions in Africa, I think, are the ones that have held it back, have prevented it developing, but are slowly and steadily being sorted out. I can't not mention Ebola. I was at a big meeting two nights ago talking about it for the experts, and the verdict seemed to be we're at a tipping point. It could go either way. We might get hold of it in Sierra Leone, which is the real threat at the moment, and then it could start spreading again, or it will be gradually contained and suppressed. And because it's such a horrible and strange disease and quite rare, there was no antidotes to it. And I said, well, of course the drug companies wouldn't do it because they didn't, you know, there's no money in it. But the reason, there is maybe a bit of that, but the other reason was that because there were no outbreaks for many years, there were nothing to test the drugs on. So they couldn't test for it. They couldn't develop drugs because they couldn't test them. Well, that was quite an interesting thing, but I think they will now. So the big picture, I think, at the moment is I feel very positive about Africa. For a long time, it was not doing well, certainly in the 90s. It's picked up since. And I think increasingly it'll be the place that the rest of the globe comes to, and not just to seize the minerals, but to bring all sorts of ideas and development. And similarly, I can see African ideas, which would have been ignored 20 years ago, now leading the world. I mean, mobile phones being the obvious example, the bank on your phone, and all the clever banking systems that are being developed in Africa. So I think, you know, Africa is catching up, and I think it will play a huge role in the next 30 or 40 years.
Thank you so much, Richard. Thank you. That was both informative and entertaining. And Mariam, I wonder whether you could bring us back from this very huge context that Richard has given to us of Africa, you know, with the 10,000 political units at the beginning, with its 2,000 languages. If we can now bring it down to your personal experience as a woman entrepreneur, because the thing that Richard highlighted is that there's a confident free market spirit starting up in Africa, and I know that so much of that lies with women.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm so honored to be here. I've looked at the report. Usually I criticize reports. So I don't like reports being written about Africa usually, because it's full of data and it's very wrong. And what I would like to congratulate you is that you actually have given opportunity to African people to write the reports. That's well done for that. I looked at the page, I looked at the 21, page 21, if you haven't read the report, but I want to just go back a little bit for what Richard said. The Africa today, Richard has, he knows the genesis of what's happening in the continent. I think it's very good that he brings the perspective of what's happened before, and for people who don't know about the continent very well, but also he's been following it up, and I've been following his work. Don't agree with everything he does, but we can have glass of wine. I
like the fact that he's bringing some perspective of what's happening. But I will give you what's happening in Africa probably in the last 5 years, probably seven 5 years.
So right now in the continent we have amazing people, really amazing people, amazing Africans who Richard may know, and they've been studying in the West. They have their PhDs, their masters, their everything. So this is the African human capital, and something you could probably call in your report as the African middle class. And they're highly educated people. And most of them live in the diaspora, and they go back home now. So now we have Africans going back home building the continent. I think they realize that we can't all stay in the West and build our continent, which is something fantastic they're doing. And those, you know, we need to thank people like Richard who've been organizing many, many events and bringing the diaspora and giving them platform in the West to do that. So thank you for doing that. So, and I think this is quite important to mention that. But the other thing I really would like to talk to you about is the fact that right now in the continent we have people who are investing in the continent. Mm. We have Africans who are investing in the continent, and they're giving a lot of money. And if you just look into the Ebola cases, for example, we have Africans giving around more than $20 million to fight the Ebola business. So if you see people like Bob Geldof and Bono who organized Band Aid, it frustrates us. I just wrote an open letter on the Huffington Post for that. And it makes us very upset that they still take control of the African narratives. And I think that the more African people are out there to write and to talk about these issues and to say no to that. And I think in the next, we will not see another Band 840, for example, because it's very wrong. And it's very wrong. And I hope that they will understand that this is wrong. But what we have right now in the continent, we have women. We have technology. We have innovation. We have policies being changed. We also have issues. We have women. We have 55 billionaires in Africa today. We have women who are extremely entrepreneurial in many, many sectors. We have also women writers in the diaspora. We have women who are writing from politics to entrepreneurship in the continent. So the prosperity for Africa for me is like, how can the African get involved? The self-confidence is coming back. People are getting confident in writing and in getting involved into the continent, which is very important. But in my work, I work with women across the globe, but also in Africa. What I've seen is the rise of young entrepreneurs, but also African women who are extremely educated and talented. So maybe we're going to change the narratives from the African woman being the object of development as the African woman who actually is running a million-dollar company. I didn't have an education. I didn't go to school. So I didn't go to school until I was 17 years old, and I think it's very important that we mention that, because you know, I didn't go to school at all because of many social issues and norms we have in Africa. And you know, my mom had us, I end up in an orphan village, and I lived in 28 foster houses where, you know, I was homeless in Paris for 1 year.
So then, you know, 40 years later, I'm running a big company in London as an African woman. So, and I employ 19 people. So it's actually incredible to see the progress. And I think what is really important is we can see the progress of Africa, and we can see the progress of African people as well. And I think that's quite remarkable. But we also need mentors. We also need people to mentor those young women. So we have like 59 tech women network in Africa. And this, we're talking about innovation. We're talking about young women who are sitting and coding. They're coding applications from PHP to Java. They really understand the coding language, and they're coding mobile apps, family planning apps, for example. And they get the support from the Melinda Gates Foundation. And this family planning is a big issue in Africa and, you know, even in Europe. But we have young women sitting in Kampala developing these apps because they feel that they need to be part of the local problems. But you also have tech hubs. We have like 92, more than 92 tech hubs in Africa right now, where you have African, young African boys and girls, guys, who are developing apps and using innovation to develop the continent. And this, I think, we need to, in the next report, you know, I think we need to start mentioning what innovation is doing for Africa. And what is really important also, we have like venture capitalists. We have Africans who are today, you know, grouping together and putting money together to start investing into those entrepreneurs. So 5 years ago, we have startups. We have like, we run competitions. You know, I ran competition for President Obama for 3 years called Apps for Africa. In that time, it was the first competition we did where we had like people running in. We were kind of like testing the market, trying to find out if we can have like, if Africa has innovation. Everybody was like reading to the hype, and M-Pesa came in. There was a hype. You know, the West, we like the hype. Africa innovation. Everybody said, hey. It's kind of cool. So we wanted to calm people down and say, like, calm down, but let's see if we can find more people to actually showcase that we have innovation in Africa. And today, we can confidently say we have innovation in Africa, we have startups, and we have people investing in them. But we need more funding. So our next step right now in 2015 is to start scaling up those companies and like building a solid tech industry in Africa where we can have like now we can, you know, in your report, for example, you can see the Africa Progress Panel report is one of the reports that actually highlighted all the innovation we have, like the ICAO in Nairobi, we have Farmerline in Ghana. Really young entrepreneurs from Africa, which 15 years ago, Richard wouldn't have that narrative to talk about. Today you have that narrative to talk about in Africa, which is really fantastic. But the other thing that is really also important to talk about is the fact that young women are getting funding. So we have African women investing in African women, in young African women, and they're mentoring them. So now they have role models. We have people like Delphine Gozi, I mentioned earlier. She's a billionaire. She's an African woman billionaire into the mining sector in Soweto. She's my mentor, that's why I mentor. and she's really investing. She's, you know, she will give $30 million to build the schools in Soweto. So you can see the progress of Africa. I'm not saying Africa is rising. I wouldn't endorse that narrative because I don't think Africa is rising. But I think Africa is progressing in a way that, you know, we're going slowly and steadily. But the only way we can actually now talk about the rise of Africa is start looking into the policies. We have really a deficit of policies in Africa. You know, when 10, 15 years ago, we had many policies written by the IMF and the World Bank. In the next 5 years, I predict that the African people will actually not listen to the World Bank and the IMF anymore when it comes to policies because they don't work. None of the policies work. And then we need to start probably now, you know, one of my biggest fight right now is to start pushing the policies around STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And this is very important for the educational sector. We have lack of skills in the continent where many companies want to go to Africa, but there's lack of skills. You know, we really have like a deficit of skills in many, many industries. So I think, you know, one of the big work we're doing right now is to find out how can we find internship, how can we find apprenticeship, how can we find people to go actually to learn more about not just, you know, the small industries we're talking about, but build bigger industries in Africa. We have the capacity, we can do that. We can tap into diaspora intellect, we can tap into the, you know, the friends of Africa, people who can really want to help Africa to kind of like start looking into the policies. But we have really big gap and big issues around policies, and I'm hoping that you know we can like implement really these policies around STEM subjects. So that's Africa right now. That's the vibe right now. That's the trend. Women are, you know, working hard, and you see people very hungry. I think what Richard said earlier about Rwanda is the same. Rwanda is the only country in Africa that have successfully implemented STEM subjects, and President Kagame did that with the Mataji at the World Bank. It's absolutely successful. Many countries have to do that, and I think right now we're talking with the White House and see how can we do, how can we implement more policies around STEM subject, because this is the core, this is the basic. For somebody who didn't have an education, I can understand why the core subjects are quite crucial. But if you think about the IMF and the World Bank, when they were going to Africa, they didn't think about this. And today you have DFID and the World Bank and many organizations giving funding to Africa. I mean, I'm talking about big money here, but they don't use that funding to invest into the STEM subject. So in the next 5-10 years, we're going to go back to the same position where people are not educated, and then we have industries looking for skills. So then that's why I'm focusing on young women and girls across Africa. And we have 200 girls in Senegal. They're absolutely brilliant, and you know, they're amazing. Everywhere you go, it's just mind-blowing. And I wanted you guys to see that.
Thank you very much to our audience, to our live stream audience, and to those of you who are here. It was an exceptionally interesting conversation. And I have to say, after a rather bleak start by Richard, because we were mining the rich soil, the rich and fertile soil of Africa's past and our responsibility for much of its challenges today, we had in Mariam Jam, I think we had such a positive personification of the Africa that can be. So I think Africa is rising.